Welcome to the Practicing Clinicians Exchange podcast series on strategies for individualizing the management of inflammatory bowel disease. This is the second of four podcast episodes adapted from a presentation conducted during a PCE Gastroenterology APP bootcamp in April of 2022. Each episode is eligible for CE or CME credit. To receive your credit at the conclusion of the podcast, please go to pce.is/IBD or click the link in the podcast notes. This episode is certified for 0.25 ANCC contact hours and 0.25 AAPA credits. In this episode, gastroenterologist Dr. Anita Afzali, gastroenterology NP Dr. Nana Bernasco, and gastroenterology PA Rick Davis will review therapeutic options, potential treatment adverse effects, and guideline recommendations. Through the discussion of a clinical case, we'll hear about applying patient-specific principles in IBD management. Now let's get started to hear about this important topic. We'll first hear from Dr. Bernasco.
So next we'll switch gears and talk about the treatments available for IBD. These are grouped into different classes and we'll go through each of them and what indications these medications are used for. So for our corticosteroids, examples include your budesonide and prednisone. This is typically used for induction in both Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. Steroids are supposed to help induce, and they're not supposed to be used as maintenance treatment for IBD. If you find that your patient is requiring multiple courses of steroids, it means that their baseline therapy, their maintenance therapy they're using is not efficient enough to keep them where they need to be, which is remission. Next class of medications that we have are your aminosalicylates. These include your mesalamines and sulfasalazine. There is really very limited evidence in use in Crohn's disease, especially in mild disease. But for ulcerative colitis, we use these class of medications for both induction and maintenance. When it comes to immunomodulators, we have your thiopurines. These include your azathioprine and 6-MP, which is 6-mercaptopurine. These are used for maintenance treatment in both ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. These medications typically take a long time to have effect, and so they are not your induction medications. But once you've gotten your patient into induction, into remission, you can use that as a maintenance therapy for them. Another class of medication that falls into the immunomodulator section is methotrexate. It has very limited benefit in Crohn's disease by itself. And in ulcerative colitis, there really hasn't been seen much benefit of its use by itself. But it can be used in combination therapies with your anti-TNF to help those levels of the drugs go up a little bit higher. And also for very severe Crohn's disease in terms of perianal inflammatory processes as well. Next, we have your small molecules. You have your S1P modulators. There's one drug that we use specifically for this in IBD that just came out. It's called ozanimod. And it's not indicated for Crohn's disease, but it is indicated for induction and maintenance in UC. We have a JAK inhibitor. Actually, as of last week, we got another JAK inhibitor that just got approved. We have tofacitinib and then upadacitinib, which just came out. These both are used in induction and maintenance of ulcerative colitis, but are not indicated in the use for Crohn's disease. Next, we have our biologics, and we have a couple of different sets of biologics. The first group of biologics that were approved for Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis are your anti-TNFs. These include adalimumab, sitralimumab, golimumab, and infliximab. I think infliximab was one of the first anti-TNF or biologics, actually, that we got approved for the use of IBD. These typically are used for both induction and maintenance in Crohn's disease, except for golimumab, which is only indicated in the use of UC. Sitralizumab is only approved for use in Crohn's disease. Infliximab is approved for both induction and maintenance of both UC and Crohn's disease. And we have our alpha-4 beta-7 integrin inhibitor. This is vedolizumab. This is indicated for both use of in Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, both in maintenance and induction. We have our IL-12/23 inhibitor. There's only one subgroup of medicine we use at this time. This is your ustekinumab. It first got approved for induction and maintenance of Crohn's disease and recently got approved for use in induction and maintenance in ulcerative colitis as well. Treatment adverse reactions that we can talk about. For your corticosteroids, you have to be really careful. I mean, those are really great drugs. It works very quickly. It gets your patients into remission, but long-term use and multiple repetitive use of this medication can be pretty detrimental to your patient. It can cause issues like bone loss, cataracts, diabetes, osteoporosis, weight gain, mood changes, you name it. Pretty much corticosteroids can cause them. And then rarely, but we do see this as a vascular necrosis of the hip, which is really, really horrible for that patient. For aminosalicylates, some common effects that you can see include nausea, vomiting, headaches, and reversible male infertility for sulfasalazine, not for the rest of the other 5-ASAs. But there is a small percentage of patients who can have paradoxical worsening of their colitis. So be really careful when you put that patient on that medicine. They tell you their diarrhea is worse. They're not crazy, I promise you. This can happen. So definitely keep an eye out for that kind of negative paradoxical effect of the 5-ASAs. A rare complication that can happen for this medication is interstitial nephritis and also pancreatitis, although low, can happen in this subgroup of medications. For azathioprine and 6-MP, which are your thiopurines, these can cause nausea, vomiting, hepatotoxicity, myelotoxicity, opportunistic infections. And again, a small percentage of patients can develop pancreatitis on this medication. Rarely can happen, but can happen. Patients can't get lymphoma on this group of medications and non-melanoma skin cancer as well. When we talk about methotrexate, a lot of times patients will complain of nausea, vomiting, hepatotoxicity, pretty much almost the same sort of reactions that you could get from your thiopurines. And one difference here with methotrexate is seen, but pretty rare, is fibrosing alveolitis. For our small molecules, and I'll add in upadacitinib, which just got approved last week, I'll put that in this group of medications as well. We have ozanimod that can cause upper respiratory infections, hepatotoxicity, some serious infections, including reduced pulmonary function. You can have hypertension, macular edema, bradyarrhythmia, and AV conduction delays can be seen in this medication use. And then for our tofacitinib and upadacitinib, which are our JAK inhibitors, you can see some nasopharyngitis, elevated cholesterol levels, increased CKP. And then for rare infections, you can have serious infections. Herpes zoster is one of those big things that you can see with this particular group of medications. Malignancy, and then we got new black box warning on thrombosis as well with the use of this medication. For our anti-TNFs, some of the common side effects you could see or adverse effects could be infections, infusion, or injection site reactions. Although these medications can be used to treat psoriasis, people can have a paradoxical effect of it and develop a psoriasis form dermatitis on these anti-TNFs. You can also have heart failure, which is rare, but I've actually seen it in actually young patients. So it can happen. Just because your patient is young does not mean some of these things cannot happen to them. I have seen it with my own eyes. So heart failure, lymphoma, melanoma, and the lupus-like syndrome. These are very real adverse reactions that can happen with patients. With your vedolizumab, you can see nasopharyngitis, upper respiratory infections, cough, infusion-related reactions. You can also have psoriasis development and gastroenteritis. I actually just saw somebody in clinic yesterday who had developed psoriasis on vedolizumab. So yes, it is rare, but it can happen, so be mindful of that side effect. When it comes to ustekinumab, which is our L1223, some patients have reported vomiting during that first induction dose, which is an infusion. Subsequent doses are a sub-Q injection. So usually with infusion, patients have reported vomiting. Some infections can happen on this medication as well. A very, very rare complication that can happen is your reversible posterior leukoencephalopathy syndrome. Again, it's reversible. Stop the medication. A lot of times when you do this, rare side effect can stop, can cease. And also skin cancer.
Okay. Well, thanks, Nana. Christian, a 36-year-old with a history of mild to moderate Crohn's disease, symptom onset age 27, starting to have increased symptoms over the past 3 months, increased stooling, some intermittent bleeding, intermittent abdominal pain, had a little bit of weight loss. His fecal calprotectin is elevated, his CRP mildly elevated as well, and his current therapy is azathioprine. What is the most appropriate therapeutic strategy for Christian? Dr. Brunesco, would you like to comment on this?
Sure. So you have a patient who is already on azathioprine. Let's look at Christian again. He's had a 3-month history of increased stool. He's having intermittent bleeding. He is already on azathioprine. And so him being on azathioprine and not responding to medication, what would you do? Again, looking at his numbers, you can see that he has skip lesions, he has cobblestoning, therefore the medicine he's currently on is not adequate to keep his disease in remission. And so we move to the next level, which is adding in an anti-TNF therapy. Now, a couple of things here. We can definitely certainly keep him on both anti-TNF and an immunomodulator, which is your azathioprine. And perhaps later on in the road, when we get him into nice deep remission, we can talk about de-escalating therapy. But yes, at this point, our patient is on standard therapy. He is not doing well. He has evidence of inflammation. He is one of your high-risk patients, again, looking at that age of 27. So yes, based on the guidelines, we do have to go to the next level of treatment, which would be your anti-TNF based on the options that we have available here. And next, we'll switch to Dr. Al-Sali to continue talking about our treatment options.
Yeah, thank you, Nana. So here, again, as Dr. Brunesco mentioned, when we're talking about guidelines and algorithms, again, I want us to take a pause and recognize that these are recommendations. These are guidelines to help guide us. They are not goal for each individual patient in the sense of you need to look at each individual patient to know what you're going to determine as far as the appropriate therapy for that individual patient. But there are some algorithms that has helped us with this, with recognizing that when we talk about for the Crohn's patient, and so again, I believe Christian had Crohn's disease, right? And so in this patient's scenario, we initially could have thought that he had that mild Crohn's disease, did not have any systemic malabsorption, no significant weight loss, and was initially started on azathioprine as he was initially probably diagnosed and managed. But over time, and as Dr. Brunesco just discussed, over time, we can see that there was a progression of his disease. And so with that progression of this disease, again, we're basing this on algorithms and guidelines. But when we look into, when we're reading our different recommendations, we recognize that when there's a progression of their disease, despite being on whatever therapy we've already initiated our patient on, now we need to optimize, change, stop, or switch treatment. So now Christian falls not just previously where he was in that low-risk patient, but progression of disease, progression of inflammation, ongoing symptoms. So this is where we could do or initiate that anti-TNF agent in combination to the azathioprine. And as Dr. Brunesco mentioned, over time, maybe we could bring Christian back to monotherapy, but it would be a monotherapy agent with a biologic alone, and stop or discontinue the thiopurine, that azathioprine. Another alternative would be methotrexate in patients who could not have tolerated the azathioprine for whatever reason. But again, methotrexate would be in combination to the TNF antagonist. We have the most robust data with combination therapy for our TNF antagonists, whether this is infliximab, adalimumab, golimumab, or certolizumab. These are your TNF antagonists. And so the combination therapy approach that we take, an immunomodulator in combination with the TNF, is recognizing that the concomitant agent helps improve drug levels of our TNF and also reduces the risk of developing antibodies to the TNF. We have not seen in the studies thus far have actually demonstrated that we don't necessarily need to practice combination therapy with our non-TNF biologics. For example, ustekinumab or vedolizumab, they do not necessarily need a concomitant immunomodulator because the risk of developing antibodies is actually quite low. And really, it doesn't add much as far as increasing drug levels of ustekinumab or vedolizumab, respectively. But there may be scenarios or situations, particularly back to those EINs I mentioned, where you might want to still add an immunomodulator because of arthropathy or because of a skin condition. So again, this is that initial treatment approach for Crohn's disease based off of algorithms, suggested algorithms, and guidelines just to help guide us for each individual patient of ours. When we talk about that high-risk Crohn's patient, so let's say Christian just got diagnosed and already has a fistula, perianal rectal abscess, some disease a phenotype that demonstrates that this patient is at high risk. Again, perianal disease or high inflammatory burden or significant extraintestinal manifestations. This is when we are absolutely reaching in straight for our biologic, recognizing those prognostic factors. He or she would be at risk of having more progression of their disease if we don't aim for that small window of opportunity of controlling the inflammatory burden. So this is where we're aiming straight for a biologic. We prefer an agent that has a good rapidity of onset, meaning when we start it, our patients will respond pretty quickly to it. And so oftentimes we aim for an infusion such as infliximab, a TNF agent, combination therapy. Again, we were wanting to optimize the likelihood that our patients will respond to the agent. And also recognizing that if there are significant comorbidities or contraindications for a TNF agent, again, these are based off of guidelines and recommendations, then for the high-risk Crohn's disease patient, we're oftentimes reaching for ustekinumab as alternative option for a biologic agent. Vedolizumab, as listed here, for moderate disease, for Crohn's disease, higher disease burden or more significant disease, again, ustekinumab. And this is just, again, based off of studies and literature and data thus far that actually has found that there's a slower response with vedolizumab in Crohn's disease as compared to ustekinumab. And then again, the TNF antagonist having the most robust data of demonstrating the best improved outcomes. Again, recognizing regardless of which biologic you're aiming for or reaching in for that high-risk Crohn's patient, you need to take into consideration patient preference. Of course, our payers, good old insurance companies, medical comorbidities such as prior malignancy, advanced age, et cetera. All of these needs to be accounted for when we're determining what the early appropriate therapy is for each of our individual patients. Recognize I'm intentional with the word appropriate. I'm not saying aggressive therapy. I'm saying appropriate therapy for each individual patient. And then what about for ulcerative colitis? Now taking a step back for that mild or moderate patient, now again, as Dr. Bernasco initially presented to us, for that ulcerative colitis patient with mild or moderate inflammation, no significant, maybe some symptoms, but not significant symptoms, this patient could be fine with a mesalamine or aminosalicylate agent. This patient may require a course of initial treatment with induction with either steroids, prednisone, budesonide, MMX, which is a formulation where it gets released only within the colon. So these could be that initial induction approach, and then maintenance of mild to moderate ulcerative colitis might just be appropriate with topical therapy based off of where the inflammation is. If it's just left-sided or primarily in the rectum, a suppository or an enema, it could be just enough. More extensive inflammation, mild or moderate extensive inflammation, would oftentimes require combination, both oral mesalamine as well as topical, whether it's a suppository or an enema. Again, taking into consideration different patient-related factors, recognizing that if, for example, they have mild or moderate inflammation, but significant joint pain, that arthropathy that parallels bowel disease activity, remember one of the E's, so maybe they have elbows or knees that we could count as that peripheral arthropathy, maybe perhaps sulfasalazine, where it could control the gut inflammation as well as the arthropathy, might be the right option. Also recognize, and please be aware of this, our mesalamine agents can get quite costly for our patients. I recently figured out that one of my patients was paying almost $1,200 a month for his mesalamine agents, and that's why he was actually non-adherent to the tablets, because it was costly. So please keep those considerations in mind when we're talking about patient-specific factors. For moderate to severe ulcerative colitis, again, highlighting very similar to Crohn's disease, you have a small window where you're trying to control the inflammation. If you don't, the inflammation continues and you continue to have more complications, higher risk of colectomy. So certainly, if your patient is having moderate to severe ulcerative colitis, having a low albumin, severe significant symptoms, knocking on the hospital door, or already hospitalized, we need an agent such as infliximab because of its rapidity of onset. And this agent is usually oftentimes, unfortunately, required even in the hospital because of severe disease. Other considerations, vedolizumab, there was the first head-to-head study that actually evaluated vedolizumab compared to adalimumab. And this is where the guidelines and recommendations comes for vedolizumab for that biologic naive patient with moderate to severe ulcerative colitis. Ustekinumab, when the guidelines were released, it was not incorporated in as far as a consideration of an option. But certainly, again, this is a non-TNF agent that can be considered for the appropriate patient with moderate to severe ulcerative colitis. And as Dr. Bernasco mentioned earlier, tofacitinib is our first oral small molecule JAK inhibitor that has been approved for the patient with moderate to severe ulcerative colitis. They have had to at least had an intolerance or failure to respond to a TNF agent. And this would be another consideration for the right patient with moderate to severe ulcerative colitis. All in all, recognizing for moderate to severe disease, whether we're discussing Crohn's disease previously or now ulcerative colitis, we're recommending early appropriate therapy. Appropriate therapy, not aggressive therapy, appropriate therapy, recognizing that these patients have an aggressive phenotype. These patients are at risk of requiring a colectomy, being hospitalized, malabsorption, anemia, et cetera. So we need to control the disease early on.
Thank you very much to our panel for that excellent discussion. And thank you to the listeners for joining us today. Tune in to the other episodes in this series to learn about diagnosis and classification, treatment goals and target, shared decision-making, evidence-based health maintenance, and much more. You can access those as well as claim your credit for this episode by visiting pce.is/IBD.